Wings, a whirlwind indeed. About 2 millennia earlier, when Sumerian ruler Gudea commemorating his building of the temple for his god Ninurta, he wrote that there appeared to him a man that shone like heaven. By the helmet on his head, he was a god. When Ninurta and 2 divine companions appeared to Gudea, they were standing beside Ninurta's divine black windbird. As it turned out, the main purpose for the temple's construction was to provide a secure zone, an inner special enclosure within the temple grounds for this divine bird. The similarity of the biblical and Sumerian descriptions, both of the vehicles and the beings with them, is obvious. The description of the vehicles as bird, windbird, and whirlwind that could rise heavenward while emitting a brilliance leaves no doubt that they were some kind of flying machine. Enigmatic murals uncovered at the Tel Gassul site east of the Dead Sea include 2 designs of mechanical craft that could well have been the whirlwinds of antiquity. An ancient coin found at Byblos on the Mediterranean coast of present-day Lebanon depicts a 2-part temple. In the center of the sacred area stands a special platform, and on the stands an object called mu, that which rises straight. There's evidence to show that the people of the eastern Mediterranean had seen rocket-like objects not only in the temple enclosure, but actually in flight. Hittite glyphs, for example, showed against a background of starry heavens cruising missiles, rockets mounted on launch pads, and a god inside a radiating chamber. Indeed, a rocket with wings or fins, reachable by a ladder, can be seen on a tablet excavated at Gezer, a town in ancient Canaan west of Jerusalem. Wishing to worship their gods throughout the lands, the ancient peoples developed the custom of setting up imitations of the god within his divine sky chamber. Stone pillars shaped to simulate the oval vehicle were erected at selected sites, and the image of the god was carved into the stone to indicate that he was within the object. Biblical references indicate familiarity with 2 types of commemorative monument, the Yad and the Shem. The prophet Isaiah conveyed to suffering people of Judea the Lord's promise of a better and safer future. And I will give them in my house and within my walls a Yad and a Shem. Literally translated, this would amount to the Lord's promise to provide his people with a hand and a name. Fortunately, however, from ancient monuments called Yads that still stand in the Holy Land, we learn that they were distinguished by tops shaped like pyramidions. The Shem, on the other hand, was a memorial with an oval top. Both, seems evident, began as simulations of the sky chamber, the God's vehicle for ascending to the eternal abode. The persistence of biblical translators to employ name whenever they encounter Shem has ignored a far-sighted study published more than a century ago by G. M. Redslob, in which he pointed out that the term Shem stems from the root word Shema, meaning that which is highward. When the Old Testament reports that King David made a Shem to mark his victory over the Arameans, Redslob said he did not make a name, but set up a monument pointing skyward. The realization that Shem in many Mesopotamian texts should be read not as name, but as sky vehicle, opens the way to the understanding of the true meaning of many ancient tales, including the biblical story of the Tower of Babel. Genesis reports on the attempt by humans to raise up a Shem. The biblical tale of the Tower of Babel deals with events that followed the repopulation of Earth after the deluge or the flood, when some of the people journeyed from the east and found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. The land of Shinar is, of course, the land of Sumer, in the plain between the 2 rivers of southern Mesopotamia. And the people said, "Let us build us a city, and a tower whose top shall reach the heavens, and let us make a Shem, lest we be scattered upon the face of the earth." The traditional translation of Shem as name has kept the tale unintelligible for generations. Why did the ancient residents of Babylonia exert themselves to make a name? Why was the name to be placed upon a tower whose top shall reach the heavens? And how could the making of a name counteract the effects of mankind's scattering on the earth? We believe that the answers to all of these questions become plausible once we read skyborne vehicle rather than name for the word Shem. The story would then deal with the concern of mankind that, as the people spread upon the earth, they would lose contact with one another. So they decided to build a skyborne vehicle and to erect a launch tower for such a vehicle so that they, too, could fly like the goddess Ishtar, for example, all over the people's lands. However, men, assert both Mesopotamian and biblical texts, could ascend to the heavenly abode only upon the express wish of the gods. The Old Testament records the ascent to the heavens of several mortal beings. The Sumerian texts also speak of several men who were privileged to ascend to the heavens. One was Adapa, the model man created by Ea. The futile search by mortal man for the tree of life is the subject of one of the longest, most powerful epic texts bequeathed to human culture by the Sumerian civilization. Named by modern scholars the Epic of Gilgamesh, the moving tale concerns the ruler of Uruk, who was born to a mortal father and a divine mother, a circumstance that prompted him to seek escape from the death that was the fate of mortals. The distant journey Gilgamesh undertook was a journey to the abode of the gods. He was accompanied by his comrade Enkidu. He said to his comrade, "I will enter the land, set up my Shem in the places where the Shems were raised up. I would raise my Shem." An unfortunate break in the tablet leaves us ignorant regarding the location of the landing place, but wherever it was, Gilgamesh and his companion finally reached its outskirts. It was a restricted zone protected by awesome guards. Weary and sleepy, the two friends decided to rest overnight before continuing. No sooner had sleep overcome them than something shook them up and awoke them. "Didst thou arouse me?" Gilgamesh asked his comrade. "Am I awake?" he wondered, for he was witnessing unusual sights, so awesome that he wondered whether he was awake or dreaming. He told Enkidu, "In my dream, my friend, the high ground toppled. It laid me low, trapped my feet. The glaring was overpowering. A man appeared, the fairest in the land was he. His grace, from under the toppled ground, he pulled me out. He gave me water to drink. My heart quieted." Gilgamesh fell asleep again, but not for long. He started up, saying to his friend, "My friend, didst thou call me? Why am I awake? Didst thou not touch me? Why am I startled? Did not some god go by? Why is my flesh numb?" Thus mysteriously reawakened, Gilgamesh wondered who had touched him. If it wasn't his comrade, was it some god who went by? Once more, Gilgamesh dozed off, only to be awakened a third time. He described the awesome occurrence to his friend. "The vision that I saw was wholly awesome. The heavens shrieked. The earth boomed. Daylight failed. Darkness came. Lightning flashed. A flame shot up. The clouds swelled. It rained death. Then the glow vanished. The fire went out. And all that had fallen had turned to ashes." One needs little imagination to see in these few verses an ancient account of the witnessing of a launching of a rocket ship. First, the tremendous thud as the rocket engines ignited, the heavens shrieked, accompanied by a marked shaking of the ground, the earth boomed. Clouds of smoke and dust enveloped the launching site. Daylight failed, darkness came. Then the brilliance of the ignited engine showed through. Lightning flashed as the rocket ship began to climb skyward. A flame shot up. The cloud of dust and debris swelled in all directions. Then, as it began to fall down, it rained death. Now the rocket ship was high in the sky, streaking heavenward. The glow vanished. The fire went out. The rocket ship was gone from sight, and the debris that had fallen had turned to ashes. He was now near to his first objective, the place where the Shems are raised up, but the entrance to the site, apparently cut into the mountain, was guarded by fierce guards. Their terror is awesome, their glance is death, their shimmering spotlight sweeps the mountains. The description brings to mind the statement in the book of Genesis that God placed the revolving sword at the entrance of the Garden of Eden to block its access to the humans. When Gilgamesh explained his partly divine origins and the purpose of his trip, the guards allowed him to go ahead. The damage and blurred text then has Gilgamesh arriving at a magnificent garden where the fruits and trees were carved out of semi-precious stones. It was there that Gilgamesh encountered a disappointing answer. Man cannot escape his mortal fate. However, Gilgamesh was offered a way to postpone death, the plant of youth. Triumphant, Gilgamesh obtained the plant, but as fate would have it, he foolishly lost it on his way back and returned to Uruk empty-handed. Putting aside the literary and philosophic values of the epic tale, the story of Gilgamesh interests us here primarily for its aerospace aspects. The Shem that Gilgamesh required in order to reach the abode of the gods was undoubtedly a rocket ship, the launching of one of which he had witnessed as he neared the landing place. The rockets, it would seem, were located inside a mountain, and the area was a well-guarded, restricted zone. Finally, let's look at the pictographic sign for gods in Sumerian. The term was a two-syllable word, Dengir. The symbol Jir was a two-stage rocket with fins. Din, the first syllable, meant righteous, pure, bright. Put together then, Dinjir, as gods or divine beings, conveyed the meaning, the righteous ones of the bright pointed objects are, more explicitly, the pure ones of the blazing rockets. Can there be any doubt that the ancient peoples, in calling their deities gods of heaven and earth, meant literally that they were people from elsewhere who had come to earth from the heavens? Even the ancient compilers of the Old Testament, who dedicated the Bible to a single God, find it necessary to acknowledge the presence upon earth in early times of such divine beings. The enigmatic section forms the beginning of chapter 6 in Genesis, the review of the spread of mankind following Adam, and the divine disenchantment with mankind that preceded the deluge or the flood. It states unequivocally that at that time, the sons of the gods saw the daughters of man that they were good, and they took them for wives, all of which they chose. The implication of these verses and the parallels to the Sumerian tells of gods and their sons and grandsons, and of semi-divine offspring resulting from cohabitation between gods and mortals, mount further as we continue to read the biblical verses. The Nephilim were upon the earth in those days and thereafter too, when the sons of the gods cohabited with the daughters of Adam, and they bore children unto them. They were the mighty ones of eternity, the people of the Shem. What does Nephilim mean? Stemming from Semitic root, it means those who were cast down upon earth. The Nephilim were the people of the Shem, the people of the rocket ships. The gods of heaven and earth of the ancient Near East not only originated in the heavens, but could also return to the heavenly abode. Realizing that such two-way travel between earth and the heavenly abode were practiced, the people of Sumer did not exile their gods to distant galaxies. The abode of the gods, their legacy discloses...